I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, just as Hoosiers head into the Labor Day weekend, we'll talk about the reasons gas prices rise and fall as they do with Tom Bowden, the chief economist in the Indiana Attorney General's office. You can call to ask or complain about gas prices at 1-866-476-3881. Labor Day also traditionally is the time that political campaigns kick into high gear. In our second half today, we'll talk with Indianapolis Star columnist Matt Tully and Evansville Courier and Press Statehouse Bureau Chief Eric Bradner about the fall election season. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can send questions or comments via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Please do join the conversation. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We have a special show today. We're talking actually about two subjects. The first one is going to be about why gas prices rise and fall. We have an expert with us, Tom Bowden, who is the chief economist for the Indiana Attorney General's office. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, John.
It's good to have you here. And I should say to everyone, Tom is going to be with us for the first half hour. So if you've got questions about gas prices, get them in before 12:30. Please call us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. So I'll take this. I think there's a pretty basic, why do gasoline prices rise and fall the way they do? That gives you a lot of room to run, so take it.
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Sure.
As we look at the composite of what makes up a gallon of gasoline, within the last month we see about 12% is taxes, which is going to be fairly stagnant. 7% is marketing and distribution, which is going to be reactionary to what price is able to bear on the market. Then 13% is refining, which we here in the Midwest have had some issues with recently. And 68% is crude oil, which is, of course, a world-traded commodity. And so it becomes a reaction. Hattiesburg Refinery in Kentucky, the Husky Energy Refinery in Toledo, Ohio, and the BP Whiting Refinery up in Whiting, Indiana, all have significant production issues. So those in the Midwest that saw gas prices spike a little bit in comparison to national average, it was because we were depleted as far as our refined supply was concerned.
Define when you say production issues for those refineries, what do you mean by that?
Well, in the Cattlesburg, Kentucky, there was a catalytic cracker that had gone down, which basically means that there is going to be a time period where their 212,000 barrels per day refinery has to go offline, and that that catalytic cracking unit was down to a fire. They have been able to get that back online from what I understand at this moment. On the Husky Energy, they did not have as much of a downtime as the Cattlesburg, Kentucky unit did, but they did have a what they have explained as an event that triggered supply concerns. And so traders in the Midwest had run up that supply price for a short period of time on Monday. The oil refinery in Whiting had experienced a compressor problem also at their coker unit. A person familiar with the operations at the plant said that it isn't clear whether the coker unit will go offline or operate at a reduced rate, but what they have is a redundant compressor capacity that's able to come in and help them get back up to speed. But these things, anytime that you have a hiccup at a refinery, and our nation refineries are averaging about 90.3% of their utilization rate, so there's not a great deal of spare capacity.
Okay.
And so these things tend to trigger some price movement because we have the supply issues.
I'm thinking in visual terms right now, and that's dangerous in radio. But that said, as you're explaining this, what seems to come to mind is the idea of a, if you will, kind of a long pipeline from the Middle East to here with some junctions along the way. And at each
sure.
stop, if there's any kind of blockage, then that obviously slows the the supply and increases the demand. Is that a fair assessment? Or?
You know, it's somewhat of a fair assessment. One of the things that I think would be important to note is that, you know, as we talk about Middle East, we're generally talking about the OPEC nations. Mm-hmm. We receive about 50% of our crude oil from them. The other 50% we receive from non-OPEC. The largest country for which we import is Canada. We get the majority of our crude oil, about 58 million barrels, from Canada. Mm-hmm. The second largest is going to be Mexico at 32.4, and then Saudi Arabia would be the third largest at 29.7 million
barrels. When you say we, are you referring to Indiana?
The United States as a whole.
The United States as a whole, okay.
Yes.
Just to clarify. So the perception that, you know, this is exclusively an OPEC-driven process is a misperception.
It is a misperception, but at 50% of our supply and the ones with the most politically tenuous relationship,
volatility,
a lot of volatility there. So they do end up making a great deal of the volatility that we experience in our crude oil pricing.
We are talking about why gas prices rise and fall with Tom Bowden, and I would like to invite listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. We've actually gotten our first question from a listener. This comes from Jim Olson, who says normally he's an Indianapolis listener but is working today in southern Indiana and will be listening to us over the Internet. Wanted to know why central Indiana gasoline prices exhibit a sawtooth pattern with sharp edges, unlike pricing for other commodities. Prices rise abruptly, fall slowly. And he says that he believes that the odd pricing stems from the fact that one chain, Speedway Marathon, tends to dominate the market here. Your answer, Tom?
That's a great question, Jim, and you have a very good assessment of why that is occurring. One of the things that we see happening, you know, Indiana, as I work for an Indiana office, our area of jurisdiction really is between the wholesale level and the retail level. So we look at these wholesale level pricings on a daily basis. What we've observed at our office over time is what I would consider to be somewhat of a rubber band effect. We have about 62% of our convenience store owners are independent owners, so they don't have a very large presence individually on the market. Speedway is our largest branded station, which has a very large presence. As we watch wholesale prices creep up, the market actually stays below where that movement is occurring. Sometimes they're selling at a loss. Speedway is the one with the market power that is able to increase that. Generally, they take on the full increase of the wholesale pricing in one foul swoop. And so the independents are able to fall into line. They are able to get back and start pricing above at what a point where they had to purchase it at. Now, if Speedway was able to, they'd like to keep that high level as often as possible. These independent stations have an economic incentive to try and gain more customers, and so they're the ones that start to drive down prices. So we usually have seen wholesale has increased significantly by the time that Speedway allows other stations to be able to price at a level that's sustainable, and then the independents are able to slowly move that down as wholesale allows so that they're able to get the customers in.
And I should probably ask, just as backdrop, why the Attorney General's office tracks this stuff, that I'm assuming there's some oversight responsibility that you have here to make sure, for example, that prices aren't being fixed or anything like that. But your answer.
Yes, we do. Back in 2002, the legislators had passed the gas gouging statute, which for guys that really enjoy looking at codes is 4-6-9.1-1.
All one of you out there.
All one of you out there. But really, it's a three-pronged statute which gives us authority to come in for any type of gas gouging situation that may or may not occur. And what has to happen is there has to be a state of emergency, that the price has to grossly exceed the average price at which fuel was readily obtainable to the retailer in the prior week, and that increased price cannot be attributable to cost factors in transportation cost. We would also be looking at issues of collusion. We would also be looking at issues of false advertising, but specific to the Attorney General's office is that responsibility for gas gouging.
Is there a problem like that? I mean, do you see much much incidence of price fixing or gas gouging or anything like that? Do you really need to use those enforcement powers that often?
We have not. We have not needed to utilize those. And in some very rare circumstances, we have had signs break where there's been mispricing on the market. An individual comes out, posts the wrong price, and because pricing is reactionary and what the market will bear, sometimes other retailers have taken that on. We have a daily tracking mechanism, and so we usually find out about those within the day that it occurs. When I'm made aware of that, I'll contact those stations directly within that same day, and every time we have had a really fair and equitable resolution from the independent retailer, from the retailer, that acknowledges this was either a mishap or something went wrong, and they make their customers whole almost immediately. They've been very good corporate citizens, but with the price at the level that it is, we certainly have that understanding that consumers really feel this in their budget. So not only do we track for purposes of that specific statute, but we also track for consumer education initiatives as well.
We are talking about gas prices, why they rise and why they sometimes don't fall, with Tom Bowden, the chief economist for the Indiana Attorney General's Office. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Well, if you could, put on your crystal ball, since you study these figures a whole lot. We're headed into a weekend where a lot of people do some driving and into a season, really, when, you know, people like to get away for weekend trips and all of that sort of stuff. Are gas prices likely to go up, likely to fall? What's your take?
As an enforcement agency, I don't like to say anything too forward-looking as it comes to prices.
Okay.
You know, you don't want to signal markets. But I can talk kind of traditionally about what occurs over Labor Day weekend. On a normal week, we see about 8.8 million gallons of gasoline consumed in the United States. When it comes to Labor Day, this bumps up to about 9.36 million gallons consumed over that weekend, which is a 6% increase in demand over a short period of time. One of the things I mentioned at the top of the show is that refineries are operating at 90+% capacity pretty much all year round. So they don't have this great opportunity to all of a sudden turn on some extra refineries to give us that extra supply that we would need for these specific weekends that close out the summer when consumers enjoy traveling so much in their vehicles. So you do expect to see a increase in demand while you have a stagnant supply, which, you know, generally is an economist would point to can lead to an increase in prices.
Well, let me ask real quickly. Is the refinery situation, I mean, would it be a genuine crisis for Indiana and all of that if those three refineries were operating at 100% capacity?
Yeah. It could. You hate to see any disruptions happen to the supply chain. You know, as you kind of mentioned, from these beginning countries out to a retail station somewhere here in Indiana, and any of those hiccups that can occur, they cause real price shocks, and consumers feel that.
Greg, welcome to the program. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
That's good. Your question?
My question, I'd like to know the practical aspect of how gas prices change. For instance, who makes the first move? And does everybody else on the street corner watch their sign, and how does it spread across the community so quickly?
Good question. We'll take it up. Thank you for calling.
Great.
Tom, please.
Thank you very much, Greg. As we had talked about with Jim's question, Speedway is usually the one with the market presence that's large enough to be able to increase these prices. One of the things that consumers will often bring to me as evidence of collusion is how quickly that is adopted in the market. There's really two factors at play, and they both come down to a sign on the side of the road. If you need to price in response to what your competition is doing, it's certainly easy for gas station attendants, who are usually able to walk out their street, look down the road and see exactly what their competition is doing. If they've been selling at a loss and their competition moves up, they now have some leeway to start making up for some of those costs, or if it's been at a narrow margin. The other point that would happen along those lines is that there is not a great deal of variability when it comes to the wholesale pricing or the rack pricing in Indiana. So a lot of these guys are affected by the same day-to-day price movements, and they know they're going to have to replenish their supply. So while some stations have purchased at a lower rate over a certain period of time, any individual gas station generally run through about 100,000 gallons of gasoline in a year, so they have to replenish this on a regular basis. So it's that ability to purchase the next gasoline that's going to the ground that is also a factor there.
We are talking about gas prices and why they rise and fall. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Mike, I understand you've got a question right on point here.
Well, yes, I have a question because I really don't understand this whole explanation. However, my question is simply that I watch gas prices go up and down here in the Indianapolis metro area, let's say. On a daily basis, I can shop gas in a 15 cent variable easily, usually. Sometimes gas changes 30 cents overnight. However, I have relatives and friends on the West Coast in Oregon and Washington. Their gas never does this. It sets for weeks or months on a given level, and I don't understand the difference. So that's my question.
Good question. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that is a great question. There's really, as we look at those geographic differences, that's usually caused by the makeup of their individual retail markets, as well as some of the environmental laws that exist out there. When you look at California particularly, they have fairly stringent environmental laws, particularly as it comes to summer blends, and so their pricing percentage at the wholesale level, because it is higher than ours, is going to be decreased in variability.
Could you walk me through that a little bit? When you say they have environmental, what sort of restrictions are they talking about, and how does that, you know, talk to me as if I were a beginning kindergartner here, and walk me through this, how it is that affects the price you pay at the pump?
All right. California would probably be a good example of that. California looks for a much cleaner burning fuel. They also have other environmental issues. They have a different type of topography than Indiana, and there's some legitimate reasons for it. But they look for a very clean burning fuel, particularly throughout the summer months. The process to refine that type of fuel makes it more expensive. It needs to be refined further than it does if it's not as clean burning. So there's not much of a market for them to sell outside of California. The environmental restrictions that they have are higher than a lot of their neighbors. So when you look at California refineries, they are refining almost solely for California's market. They don't have a market to sell outside of California, and California can't bring in fuels that are refined by others that don't refine to those specific standards. So you have this kind of separate market that exists on the West Coast.
So if we, here in Indiana, if we imposed more environmental regulations on gas, would that serve to help stabilize the prices?
What we have seen from other states that have done this have seen that it does help stabilize prices, it increases prices, and it increases margins for retailers.
Well, but it sounds like it would stabilize them upwards.
They'd be stable upward. Yeah, it'd be more costly, and that's, yeah.
Lane, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Your question?
Yeah, I heard a comment there that was like 90 to 95% of the oil refineries are working at their capacity. Some of the other programs I've heard recently have been saying not nearly 80%. I wonder where that number comes from or how long we've been operating so high. And along with how many refineries do we have permits and approvals to build, yet we refuse to build them because they don't want to move the supply chain up?
Good question. We will take it up. Thanks for the call. Tom, why more refineries? What would be involved there?
More refineries is going to be really more of an EPA issue than a state attorney's general issue. One of the things that we have seen, though, is there's a significant lack of new refineries coming online. Back in 1982, we had 301 refineries in the United States. Today, we have 148. That's a 51% decrease in the number of refineries. But
what accounts for that?
Primarily what accounts for that is as we look at the early 80s, we saw a drop in crude runs and crude refining capacity, which refineries are very, very expensive to keep operating. So there is a significant amount of capital expenditure that goes into producing any of these, and there's a significant amount of capital expenditure that goes into operating one that might not have been operating at capacity. So we saw this drop-off occur that has since what we've seen make up that difference, though, is the ability to produce more per each refinery. So we've got about 17 million barrels a day that we're able to refine in the United States compared to 17 million barrels per day we were able to refine when we were operating under 301 refineries. Now, to his question about how long have they been operating at 90% capacity on an annual average, that would have been 1994.
Oh, so for the past 17 years, they've been averaging 90%. Is that when the number decreased?
The number decreased really throughout the 80s.
Okay, so it was a slow decline, and then at 94, we hit about this 90% threshold. And is that probably the most efficient threshold? I mean, normally things stabilize for a reason at a number like that. And is there not any real incentive out there now to build more refineries? That was the other part of his question, is do we have permits and why aren't we building more if that's the case?
No, and that's a great question. One of the reasons why we're not building, why you don't see new refineries being built, talking to those individuals who are on that side of this market, not on the regulatory side, the response I normally receive is that they're hopefully optimistic that that technology will continue to happen. Now, I do know that there has been requests for new refineries, but in that case, you hit up against the EPA, you hit up against the Department of Energy. It's a long, drawn-out process. It's a capital-intensive process. And then you also have on the consumer and the NIMBY issue, the not-in-my-backyard issue, where everybody wants a new refinery, just nobody wants it close to
them. Yeah, wants the things that come with it. How much would it cost, I mean, in ballpark terms, to build a new refinery? I mean, I want to give people some idea of, I'm assuming we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars?
Oh, yeah. Upper hundreds of millions.
Okay, so close to a billion, basically. And that's a significant wall to get over if you're wanting to invest in doing it. We are talking about why gas prices rise and fall with Tom Bowden, the chief economist for the Indiana Attorney General's office. You've got time for just one last question. If you want to call us, 1-866-476-3881, or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. What is the biggest sort of threat that is out there right now in terms of seeing gas prices spike, would you say, Tom, going forward? What's the thing that we have to worry about the most?
You know, as we're switching over from the summer blends into the winter blends, the refinery issues are a little less substantial than they are because you don't end up having these myopic markets across the United States. So when we move into the fall area, we look more at the crude oil prices as being the major drivers. One of the things that we see is popular media really reports the price of light sweet crude, which is hovering about, as of this morning, was about $88.79. The rest of the world quotes on Brent crude oil, which is currently trading at $114.29. Through arbitrage, these things generally get back in line. Light or Brent crude has had some issues in Nigeria as far as extraction is concerned, and in the North Sea as far as extraction is concerned. So there is a concern to watch which is going to move in whose direction. Is Brent crude going to start coming down to match light sweet, or is light sweet going to start moving up to match Brent crude?
We have run out of time. I want to have you come back. I find this fascinating to talk about, among other things. Next time we sit down, I want to know the difference between the summer and the winter blend. It sounds like a Starbucks thing to me, but and all of that about how closely you track this. Thank you for coming in. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much, John. We have been here.
Certainly. We have been talking with Tom Bowden, Chief Economist for the Indiana Attorney General's Office. We're about to be joined by Matt Tully of the Indianapolis Star and Eric Bradner of the Evansville Courier and Press. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We just finished talking with Tom Bowden, Chief Economist for the Indiana Attorney General's Office, about gas prices. We're shifting gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about the arrival of the start of the kickoff, really, of the fall election season, when campaigns tend to kick into high gear right after Labor Day. We're joined by Matt Tully, columnist for the Indianapolis Star. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. And Eric Bradner, State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press. Eric, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
And I probably should just do a quick disclosure here. I sit on boards with both of these guys and have known both of them for years. So real quickly, we've got a bunch of mayor's races and really a Senate primary campaign that's kicking into high gear. And, of course, a lot of anticipation about Indiana was a battleground state 4 years ago, about whether it's going to be a battleground state again. Matt, what things are you watching now the most closely? What are you most interested in?
Well, I'm most interested in the mayor's race here in Indianapolis. I think it's got ramifications on all sides. First of all, you have two pretty good candidates, though I don't think they're running particularly good campaigns right now. But
why not good campaigns?
Well, because they're. I think this is a time in Indianapolis' history where we've had a nice growth in the city for quite a while, 30-40 years, and I think there are major issues facing the city, and I just don't think either candidate is really talking about them. I don't think they're offering big visions for the next 4 years, big ideas. I think both are playing very cautious. I think both see a path to victory that involves not getting people riled up, getting out their base, and winning on election day. I surely would like to see these folks talking in big, bold ways about the issues facing the city, education, crime, the economy, things like that. And so far, it's been a very quiet campaign. They're on the air. They're occasionally having press conferences. The Ballard campaign, the incumbent, he has a pretty good record to run on. But his campaign seems scared of putting him out there. It's almost like they don't trust him to go out there and wing it in front of the media, in front of the voters, things like that. So they've been very quiet. The Kennedy campaign's talking about the issue I care most about, education, but I don't think they've offered a really, full-fledged education platform. I think they've talked about early childhood education, which is nice, but there's a lot more that goes into that. There's questions of mayoral control of districts like IPS and what we're going to do about getting more families involved in education in the heart of the city. So I don't think they've really offered a comprehensive plan about education, not to mention the other issues I discussed.
We are talking about the fall election season with Matt Tully and Eric Bradner. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Eric, what issues are you tracking right now, or campaigns are you watching the most closely?
Sure. Well, the 2011 mayoral races are going to give us an indication of where Indiana stands in terms of its political makeup and what's changed since 2010. Three races that you might want to watch that will be good barometers are the mayoral races in Evansville, Anderson, and Muncie. Those three will all be pretty close.
Why those three?
All places where, you've got an incumbent running in Anderson and Muncie, not in Evansville, but places where Democrats, ought to win, have won in the past, but don't necessarily look as strong this year. Evansville in particular is interesting. You've got a Democrat who is from outside the party establishment against a Republican who is very much an insider there, which is sort of the opposite dynamic of what we're seeing a lot of places now.
And are you watching any of the – obviously, we've got a Senate primary campaign that seems to be getting – actually drawing more heat, and there seems to be more energy associated with that than the active campaigns right now. Are you watching that one?
Absolutely. What's interesting about the Senate primary right now You've got.
We ought to take a step back and explain to some people who don't live and breathe this stuff that it's Senator Richard Lugar's being challenged within the Republican Party by Richard Murdoch, who is the state treasurer. They're both Republicans, and Murdoch's affiliated with the Tea Party movement.
Sure. And then you've got a Democrat, Joe Donnelly, who is sort of a centrist type candidate from South Bend, who's very much hoping to take on Murdoch. So there are three big-time candidates in the race right now, yet the most interesting person isn't running yet, at least. It's Mike Delf, the state senator from Carmel, a Republican who would appeal to the same type of Tea Party people who are in Murdoch's camp right now or are thinking about getting into Murdoch's camp. Now, we don't know if Delf is going to run, and if I had to guess, I would say no, he's not going to. But what he has done is indicate he's not going to give an answer either way until after the November elections, which has the effect of freezing a lot of money out that would go to Murdoch right now. It's a great thing for Lugar that Delf is still, you know, playing around, acting like he might not get in, because, you know, the prospect of running against two Tea Party candidates is much better for Lugar than running against one of them. And the longer it looks like there might be another candidate, the longer the money stays on the sideline.
We are talking about the start of the fall campaign season with Matt Tully and Eric Bradner. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Matt, you raised the question of mayoral control over education. And that is kind of a big one. Is that one of the reasons that the candidates sort of don't quite know how to engage with that issue, you think?
It's a real tough issue, and there's a reason that Indianapolis hasn't done this over time, hasn't done things like merging districts over time. Mm-hmm. It's very, very sensitive, especially in a county that is pretty well known for UniGov and merging all kinds of things, and there's been a push in recent years to do even more of that, but education's kind of the third rail there. It polls very poorly. You know, that explains specifically why Ballard's staying away from it. He knows it just wouldn't play well if a Republican was pushing to take over IPS, which is the district that, if you're going to have a reasonable conversation, most of the other districts in IPS in Indianapolis are run relatively well. IPS is where the problem is. That's where the state is taking over schools. So if we're talking about mayoral control, you're talking about IPS. You know, I think the Kennedy campaign is you know, getting some of their supporters want them to push it, but they know it's a tough issue to come out and run on, because there's the establishment is so powerful. There's so many ramifications of suggesting a takeover of a school district that they just don't want to go there. And I don't know that they need to take over the schools. There are all kinds of other things you can do. You can seek mayoral appointments on the school board, which I think would have a huge impact, because then you can guarantee that you're putting some really high caliber top people on the school board and pushing for the kind of reforms that a lot of people want from the school board without doing everything that goes into taking over a school district, which if you do that, you might be costing yourself 5 years of just getting the mechanics in place of taking over the district. So I don't know that a full takeover is necessary. I think some mayoral action is needed. I think we all here live in the city. Most people know the issue that affects Indianapolis most is the quality of its schools. It's why so many families move to the suburbs. It's why so many people don't feel comfortable living in the city, because they worry about the schools. To have the mayor sitting on the sideline largely, and I'm not talking about this mayor, but mayors in general, sitting on the sideline on the most important issue affecting your city, it just makes no sense. I think the mayor needs to get more involved.
Well, and some of that is the structure, too. And I'm not going to out anyone, but I'm old enough to have known the mayors for pretty much since dinosaurs roamed the earth. And one of them said that, you know, back in the, well, I probably shouldn't because I'll give that person away, who said this, but said there is really no percentage in the mayor trying to get involved in the politics of running a school system, in part because you don't have the authority to control anything. So all you do is tick people off without being
able to
affect
change. And you assume a lot of responsibility. And then every year when the State Department of Education comes out with the F's grading your school, that's an F on your doorstep. And that's true. And I guess that's what we have to decide is, do we want mayors that continue to avoid the big, tough issues, or do you want the kind of mayor who says, no, I want to take that responsibility because that's the future of our city. And that's what I was kind of hoping to see in this mayor's race. I think another reason this is an interesting mayor's race, and this might not end up being exactly true, but if you look at the changing demographics politically of this county, it's getting more and more Democratic by the election cycle. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say this is probably the last time a Republican has a fair shot of winning the mayor's race. In Indianapolis by 2015, 2019, it's going to be really hard unless you have such a good Republican candidate and such a bad Democratic candidate. It's going to be really hard for Republicans to win countywide in Marion County. So this might be the last great chance we have, the last chance we have for a really great mayoral election. And I haven't seen it yet. I'm hoping post-Labor Day we see more of it.
And Eric, in terms of the three mayor's races that you're watching, what are the issues there that people seem to be arguing about?
That's a good question. I mean, a lot of the same issues that we're talking about right now. I mean, it doesn't seem like there are mayoral candidates across Indiana who are really presenting compelling visions right now for how they'd like to see their city operate. I mean, one person worth watching, and this is, you know, not one of the three. This is somebody that is getting a little bit of attention and is running for re-election as well up in Kokomo, is Greg Goodnight, whose city has been sort of the star of, you know, the CNN program about a city being saved by the stimulus and whatnot. But you're not seeing a whole lot of ideas come out of the cities.
Well, well, you know, John, it's a whole lot easier to have those ideas when you have some money to spend behind those ideas. And cities are being crushed right now by their budgets. Indianapolis is slightly unique because it has that huge pot of money that it's raised from selling the water and sewer utilities. And even though the Kennedy campaign has raised questions about that deal under Ballard, they also fund their biggest proposal, early childhood education, with that money. So, or they would fund it with that money. So you know, it takes a true visionary to come up with ideas for your city, big bold plans for your city when you have no money.
We are talking about the kickoff of the fall campaign with Eric Bradner and Matt Tully. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. When we're talking about it, it's almost as if, with the exception of Kokomo and Greg Goodnight, really, right, we're talking about a kind of a timidity on the part of candidates. What accounts for that? I mean, when you talk to people, I guess I'll ask that as a two-part question, because their timidity seems to be balanced by an incredible volatility mm-hmm. on the part of the electorate. Why? Who wants that one first?
I can start, because right, I think I have a pretty good answer, and I think it's the low turnout mm-hmm. in municipal elections. You're talking 22, 23, 24% in a good year turnout, and the people who turn out, and this is not a criticism, but tend to be older, tend to be more lower C conservative, not meaning politically conservative, but maybe a little less interested in the big bold things that we're talking about. Maybe just want to see their city, you know, survive for another 10, 20 years. But when you only have, you know, one-fifth of your city coming out in an election, and they tend to be the more anti-tax folks and people who maybe don't want the boat rocked as much, I think there's disincentive for candidates to offer these big bold plans. If every 20-something in this city was coming out in the elections in November, my guess is Greg Ballard and Melina Kennedy would be offering much bigger, bolder ideas for the future, because they know that, you know, 20 and 30-somethings might be more receptive to that message than what we see in these elections, which is, you know, a lot of people in their 50s and 60s and 70s voting.
Sure, yeah.
Eric, please.
The turnout number is going to be dictated in large part by whether one the boat rocked. You know, you nailed it. And if you do that, you've got a serious problem. If you make enough older people uncomfortable or irritated with your direction, then you've got a bigger problem than you would if you were running in 10 or 12, you know, a year that is going to see some bigger name candidates on the ballot for governor or president or Senate or Congress or whatever.
So is this a good thing? I mean, having the mayoral elections, the city elections, really off cycle then, so that there is no larger state or national campaign going on at that time. Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
You know, it's a good idea in theory, because the theory is that you have the local elections in an off year, so that's all you focus on. So everyone gets to really focus on the mayor's race, but the people just don't come out in these races. Even 2007 here in Indianapolis, which was a huge mayoral election year that got so much attention, mm-hmm. it was 23 or 24% turnout. So even that didn't get a lot. If we were getting 50, 60, 70% turnout in these off years, I'd say absolutely great idea that we could focus solely on the mayor's race. It doesn't happen. So I really think we need to consider moving it to either a midterm year or a presidential election year where you have a much larger turnout, many more people paying attention. People say it'll be overshadowed by the presidential race and the governor's race, but you know, I think people are smart enough to, you know, add one more race to their ballot and still pay attention to what their mayor's doing. And I think it would be very helpful to have a broader group of people voting in the election.
Eric, your thoughts on that?
Sure. Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, as Matt said, it's the idea is that people focus exclusively on municipal elections, but it just instead of focusing exclusively on the elections, people don't pay attention to elections at all. Mm-hmm. In part because, you know, if candidates aren't offering a compelling vision, then why bother? I think, you know, you move municipal elections to
you know, I think that totally I think this the perfect example of the problem with the current system is mass transit. Mm-hmm. I think both candidates would be out front pushing for mass transit for a referendum next year that they've talked about, that mm-hmm. some people have talked about, to fund a regional mass transit system. If you were getting 50, 60, 70% turnout, because it would be a much broader, more diverse group of voters. But since the electoral pool is about 22% and tends to be folks that are anti-tax and as both of us said, don't want the vote rock so much, these candidates are terrified of being tagged as pro-tax.
Well, sure,
come out. Even though I think if you talked to a much broader group of people in the city, they'd say, yeah, mass transit is something we need to consider. These candidates won't even talk about it this session.
Well, in the last, you know, mayoral race came at, you know, as the property tax thing was exploding across the state.
And was one of the factors that took Bart Peterson out and put Greg Ballard
sure,
in.
Sure, absolutely. And so that's what all of these
and a lot
candidates
of,
are remembering.
A lot of incumbents across the state, right? Basically. It was pretty much bipartisan. If you were in office at that point, you were out in front of the gun sites.
I think it was the Tea Party before we realized there was a Tea Party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and in some ways, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like what you're saying, too, is because the demographic skews older on, I realize I'm lapsing into jargon here, because more people my age vote in these city elections. It's not just that they're opposed to taxes, but something like mass transit that, you know, might take a few years to come online, I begin to think, well, wait a second, you're going to spend my money on that, and I may not be able around it to be able to take advantage of it. Is there
something I'll never use, maybe?
Yeah.
You know, but for the city, I think most people agree is a good economic development and environmental move. But yeah, I have no doubt in my mind that if everyone in the city was voting this year, that Melina Kennedy would be out saying, yeah, let's do mass transit. But, you know, she's obviously very worried about an ad saying she would raise your taxes, you know, $100 a year, whatever, so she can't go there based on who they know is coming out to vote this year. I'm not criticizing the people that are coming out to vote. I'm just saying it tends to be a more, you know, anti-tax crowd than the overall city.
And keeps the campaigns really, to use the old image, of instead of playing with the whole football field, they fight it out between the 45-yard lines.
Both these candidates are so focused on turnout, and on turning out their base.
Yeah.
That's what they're focused on. They're not focused on the stuff affecting the vast majority of the city.
We are talking about the fall election season. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Bob, welcome to the program. How are you?
Hello. I'm fine, thank you. I have a question regarding the three mayoral races your guest indicated would be of interest.
Sure.
One of them they mentioned was Anderson. I've lived around Anderson most of my life, grew up there, and I guess I'm really interested why Anderson matters.
Okay.
I mean, I understand that the...
We've just offended most of the city, but that's okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, the majority of the majority employer, I guess, if you want to call it that, source of revenue for Madison County is transfer payments. I don't see a whole lot of opportunity for the, the visionary that you described with the bold idea to come in when Anderson doesn't have anything remotely resembling an educated workforce. I'm wondering why anyone would want to be mayor of Anderson, and assuming that some people do, why it would be an interesting race. It seems to me that generally it would be a foregone conclusion, but I'm interested in the answer.
Sure. Great. Thank you very much, Bob, for the call. Mm-hmm.
Well, you raise an interesting question about why anybody would want to be mayor of Anderson, because the two candidates are the same people who ran in 2007. You've got the Democrat who won by a couple hundred votes running against the Republican who narrowly lost again. So evidently at least two people want to be mayor of Anderson. It's an interesting race as a political test. In terms of, the actual city of Anderson, I mean, you've lived there and I haven't, so you're much more about that than I do. However, the problems you were describing are exactly why a place like Anderson needs a candidate who has some sort of vision to change those factors that have, you're right, a lot of major employers, especially in the auto industry, have left the city of Anderson over the last couple of decades, and it has led to very high unemployment in that area, especially over the last 5 or 10 years. You were seeing unemployment spike there well before the recession hit. So, why would somebody want to do it?
Let me reframe this a little bit. And Eric, not to give anything away here, but you're slightly younger than Matt and I are. You're part of that 20-something group. What do you think a mayor should be doing, a mayoral candidate should be doing, to speak to people who are your age and motivate them to come out and vote?
Mass transit is one great example, especially in the Indianapolis area, but not limited to the Indianapolis area. Central Indiana reaching out to places like Anderson, that could appeal to people my age. I think education is something that Matt mentioned, and in terms of mayoral races, sorry, not to take us too far off track, but the city of Indianapolis made the choice in the 1970s when discussing city-county consolidation not to merge the school districts, and that has had a dramatic effect on what the city looks like, in the decades since then. The city had the opportunity, leaders then had the opportunity to say education is something that we're going to get serious about. It's something we're going to put under, the arms of a mayor, and it chose not to. That was a lack of leadership then when Richard Lugar was mayor, and it's still one now.
Yeah, and I will say, as someone who was around the edges at that point, I want to make it clear, I'm not saying whether this was a good thing or a bad thing, but the political calculation at that time is you're not going to get Unigov through. I mean, it was a tough sell as it was, if you include the schools. Similarly, there was a similar decision about busing here, that the buses really were only going to run one way. They were going to take kids out to the suburbs, but they weren't going to bring them back in, right, bring kids from the suburbs back into the city. And all of that. So it's a larger point that, for 40 years, obviously, we've struggled with that. If you guys were, Matt, I'm gonna toss this. If you were advising each of these candidates, and I realize that's not necessarily your job, but I'm gonna ask you to step out of that for a second, and you wanted, within their philosophic frameworks, because those are different, you wanted some sort of transformative gesture or statement or stance for them. Start with Ballard. What would you advise the mayor to do?
I would advise him to swing for the fences on the issue of rebuilding the urban core. He already has things that he could point to that are starting that, whether it's the infrastructure work that's going on in the city, the Busch Stadium redevelopment they've proposed, a few other downtown, the Keystone Towers coming down. I mean, he already has a lot of the pieces in place. I think what he needs to show is that we have a real specific long-term plan to bring people back into the city, to bring development back into the city, to fight the problems that affect cities all over this country, that we're going to be the unique city that doesn't have our core hollow out that, further. We're going to reverse that. If I was him, I think that's where his strength is. His strength is in the nuts and bolts. So I would maximize that and say, you know, instead of just repaving roads, how are we using all of that infrastructure, all that development work to really rebuild the urban core, which is the big challenge in the city.
And Melina Kennedy, what would you advise there?
I would say take what you've done in education and put it on steroids. It's great. I tell you, I'm such a supporter of early childhood education. As someone who spent a lot of time in schools writing about stuff going on in schools, I can tell you every teacher I've ever talked to says the problem starts before the kid gets to their classroom. And no matter how great that teacher is, they struggle with what happened in the first 5 years of that kid's life. And so I appreciate that she's done that. I think she needs to go a lot further and to show what else she would do to rebuild the schools, what she would do to expand the charter schools network, what she would do to take advantage of the laws that the state just passed, and how she would be involved to make sure that we have really high caliber people on the school boards, because I think that's a huge issue in the city.
And Eric, we got about 10 seconds here, but real quickly, what do you think the biggest surprise in this election season that will extend through the primaries will be?
Extend through next year's primaries?
Yeah.
What will the biggest surprise be?
Yeah. Good question.
We don't know
question.
Yet. We don't know yet. I think it will relate to the strength of the Tea Party.
Okay. And we'll know one way or the other on that.
Yeah.
Guys, thank you very much for joining me. We've been talking with Matt Tully of the Indianapolis Star and Eric Bradner of the Evansville Courier and Press. Before that, we had Tom Bowden, the chief economist for the Indiana Attorney General's office. Next week, we are going to be talking about the anniversary of 9/11 with some of the people who lived through that awful day. Please send us your email memories of that event to nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm John Kroll. Thank you for spending this time with us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer Sharon Alsep. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m. And you can listen online at WFYI.org.